Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. Whether it's helping a single mom in Dundalk keep her home or giving a bright student in Sandtown a chance to be his best, United Way fights for families. Help them win the fight. Visit uwcm.org/fight.
This is Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun with episode 443 of the Roughly Speaking podcast. Today, an encore visit with award-winning Baltimore Sun photographer Amy Davis. Amy Davis devoted 10 years to a book about Baltimore's bygone movie theaters. The book is called Flickering Treasures. It was published last year. Now, more than 70 of Amy's photographs are part of an exhibit that just opened at the National Building Museum in Washington. Amy says the exhibition covers four galleries and includes a mini theater that gives the feel of a Saturday matinee. The show is more than photographs. It includes a display of artifacts from old theaters. Voices of Baltimoreans, culled from Amy's oral histories, are sprinkled throughout the four galleries. The exhibition takes a deeper dive into the African-American entertainment district along Pennsylvania Avenue. It also explores segregation and the impact that Morgan State students had on desegregating the Northwood Theater. I spoke with Amy shortly after Flickering Treasures was published, and we talked about her long project to capture what remained of Baltimore's forgotten movie theaters. Amy, so it seems to me you came into my radio studio at WYPR 8 years ago. Could it be 8 years ago? And you said, listen, I'm working on this project and I want to talk about it on the air. And we did. We talked about old movie theaters on the air because you were looking for people who remembered them. Am I remembering correctly?
Exactly. You were kind enough to have me on Midday Live.
Was that 8 years ago?
You know.
9 years ago?
That was probably at least 7 years ago.
Okay.
At least, because I started it because I lived near the Senator. And when the Senator faced foreclosure, I thought, this is my neighborhood theater. Later on, when I talked to a lot of other people, I realized so many people had that same identity with their neighborhood and their neighborhood theater. But I had never experienced that growing up in split-level suburbia on Long Island, New York. So I really was captivated by the Senator and loved the fact that I could see the searchlights from my upstairs bedroom window. And to think that that theater would close made me so sad. But then, I guess as a journalist, I thought, well, what happened to other theaters? I just wanted to anticipate what would happen to my neighborhood theater, because it occurred to me, you know, the light bulb went off. This already happened to every other theater. That's why the Senator was known as the last single-screen theater. And I was surprised at how many theaters there are. And that began my hunt for the theaters and captivated my interest. I already loved the Senator and was interested in architecture, interested in Baltimore history. And it just seemed like a perfect topic to explore so many things. So that's when I decided to do a book. It's really astonishing that the highest peak for a number of theaters at one time that came in 1916, there were 129 theaters.
Now, I'm thinking about this.
Imagine.
As I'm looking at your book. Well, I'm thinking about it. It totally makes sense, and this may seem completely obvious. There was no television. Most people probably didn't even have radios back then. And we have all these neighborhoods in Baltimore, right? We have 200 and something, I don't know, 300 neighborhoods. And so people wanted to see the Flicker Show, and they went to what was convenient, a place where you could walk to or take a streetcar to.
Exactly. A lot of the theaters were located on streetcar lines, virtually all of them, and every neighborhood had one. But back in 1916, a lot of them were concentrated downtown. So when movies caught on, moving pictures, these were silent movies, of course, people would just sort of set up a storefront theater. Those were the Nickelodeons, because they cost a nickel. And so there was no television. This was a great form of entertainment. The shows would change as movie theaters evolved. The shows would change three times a week. And so people would go three times a week. One woman shared the diary, her mother's diary. And as a teenage girl, she talked about how many movies she went to in a given week. It was just astonishing that she ever got through school. She seemed to be at the movies all the time, and she was typical.
Think what that would have done for social life in Baltimore, or did for social life in Baltimore. You were out of the house. You were on the sidewalk. You saw your neighbors. You saw other people. Of course, in the movie theater, you weren't talking to anybody, but still, you were out at night two or three times a week for this entertainment and not sitting at home, everybody tucked away at home.
It was a communal experience. Typically, there would be an Arundel ice cream store located next door, maybe a Reed's, so there was always another place
store.
To go to have a Sunday afterwards or whatever. But yes, everybody went to these destinations in their neighborhood, and I wish these theaters could become that again. That's one of the things I wanted to accomplish with the book. Look at these places. They were the communal anchors in their neighborhood. Some, like Creative Alliance, the former Patterson Theater in East Baltimore, became that. It is a really lively arts nonprofit organization, and it has helped revive Highland Town. There's no doubt about it.
And the senator that you mentioned at the outset here, for those who don't know who are listening and aren't familiar with this, is a grand Art Deco theater from the 1930s, mm-hmm. right? And it's still there. It's still going. They've changed it so that there are more screens inside. It's amazing what they did with the same footprint of that building, putting more screens inside. And that's my neighborhood theater, too. But it's a destination theater for people who want that experience. I wanted to ask you about the Charles on Charles Street. People are familiar with that complex of theaters today, but there were theaters there before then, right? I didn't know this until I got into your book. There was the Time Cinema, right? The Time Theater.
The history of that building is great because that was an early example of reuse in architecture, which is very trendy now. You take an old warehouse or a factory and you make it into some new entertainment complex. But this was done back in 1939. This was the old Baltimore Traction Company powerhouse. It was where they powered the cable cars back in the 1890s. So, of course, we know what happened to the cable cars. Those were gone. And in 1939, they turned it into a newsreel theater. All they showed were newsreels. And, of course, this was leading up to World War II, so this was a really compelling thing. Exactly.
It was like CNN.
So instead of going to your phone or TV news, you would pop in and see what was happening overseas. And maybe you could even catch a glimpse of your son, you know, in some movie footage. So it was located near the train station, and there were newsreel theaters around the country. It was a popular thing. There's one that's been preserved. It's not functioning, but the space has been preserved in Cincinnati in their old train station.
So that's the same building that we know today as the Charles Theater.
Exactly. So if you had time between your trains and you wanted to catch up what was going on, you could just stroll up to the Times and see a few newsreels and then be on your way. And they would be open late so that they could accommodate factory workers.
Now, Amy, you set out to take photographs of these old theaters that are in reuse now. Some of them, they're in different stages of reuse or dilapidation, right? Or some are gone.
Right.
And I was interested in this quote from your preface. I sought a dialogue with the past, not its replication. And here you're writing specifically about your approach to these photographs. What do you mean by that?
Many books that have old photos, vintage photos, are popular. Everybody loves to look at the old pictures. And so they're what's called a then and now book. But I don't consider my book a then and now book specifically, even though it has pictures from then and pictures from now, more or less over the past 8 years. Because I didn't stand in the same spot that the photographer stood in. Because I always found, for those books, the old pictures were so intriguing, and the new pictures were not as interesting, except to tell you what was there or wasn't there anymore. I wanted to make pictures that stood on their own as photographs, as art, and would say something about my feelings about that space, that streetscape today. And so I wasn't going to be tied down to copying the old photo. In some cases, it's not possible. But I thought I could say more about what the space looked like now by taking a fresh look. Having said that, I was still inspired by the old photos. There are some pictures that definitely riff off the old pictures. The Hartford Theater is one.
Well, let's go to that. I was going to go to that. There is a spread. There is a then and now spread on pages 108, 109. You have photographs and prose about the Harford Theater, 1916 to 1960, and then today. So one photograph from way back when is in the winter of February of 1928. And it looks like all men went out to see this movie theater the first time, I guess. They're all in winter coats and great-looking hats. And the street is just full of men, I guess, waiting to get into this movie theater, right?
The street is packed. And when I got this picture was lent to me by Jacques Kelly, our Sun columnist. He lent me several pictures, and I'm very grateful for that. And neither of us actually knew what this was all about.
Jacques's in the picture, isn't he?
It's, I'm kidding. Well, I don't know if he has one of those newsboy caps, but
it sure looks like Jacques in one of these.
Every fellow has one of those great newsboy caps or a hat on.
I want one of those hats.
And so it's just you could look at that picture for hours. But as I was doing my research, I came across this battle to end the blue laws, the restriction against screening movies on Sundays. After all, you were supposed to be in church. And there was a camp that wanted to keep it that way. And then there was another group who thought the city could not develop and expand if it was closed up on Sunday, that it could never be a big-time metropolis. So the leader of this group, the Liberty Defense League, was John Callan. And he was a plumber. And a very outspoken fellow, and he was also in the House of Delegates. And so he would organize these tests to that Sunday Blue Law. So he challenged it by showing a movie on Sunday. Instead of having customers pay for tickets, which would have been a violation of the law, they just bought programs. And they showed a movie called Dumbbells, which I think was definitely his commentary on the powers that be at the time. And the word was out, so it looked like 3,000, I think about 3,000 people.
Showed up,
according to the newspaper accounts that I read. And that's an—
You can believe that from that photograph.
That's exactly. The Harford is on across from Clifton Park
right. On
Harford Road.
Well, so let me ask you about the photograph across from the old photograph that's in this spread here in your book. It looks like a pastor and his flock, and I guess the Harford is now a church.
Yes.
Is that right? And they're all out in Harford Road. There's not 3,000 of them, but they fill up the photograph pretty nicely. It's a beautiful shot. Tell us about that picture.
Well, I would visit all of these theaters, and I was interested in the fact that so many of them had become churches. And so I was always curious to see how much they had changed, what had been preserved. So I had stopped in, and I had talked to Pastor Bishop Clarence Weston, who was really a very kind, wonderful guy, explained to him what I was doing. He made me feel welcome. And because I had learned the history of this old photo, I had the idea that it would be wonderful to show the community that exists now. Because in all of my pictures, I'm trying to show the life around the theaters, not just the buildings. Who lives and works in the area now? So it just seemed like a natural thing to have him invite his congregation. So it was a very impromptu thing. I don't think the congregation knew about it in advance. And some of the people in this photo were just visiting the church that day.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been for the soup kitchen or something. But at any rate, they weren't necessarily all official congregants, but they were all game to come out for a quick photo. And so we set it up outside. And I think it has a nice feel to it.
Oh, it's great. Both photographs.
And you can actually see that the building is remarkably unchanged.
And the row houses next to them.
It's a very handsome neoclassical facade. But you would never know going by that theater today that it had ever been a theater.
Well, talk a little bit about that, would you, Amy? I'm assuming theaters became churches because they had seating. They were theaters, right? It seems sort of like a natural flow, and they were in neighborhoods. There was a lot of them, and probably they were cheap to rent or buy even.
Yes, the conversion from theater to church is a natural one. As you said, you've got the seats, you've got the stage. The sloped floor is not a problem. It's expensive to level the floor if you want to convert a theater to a building. And one theater owner, Morris Klein, was a realtor in town, and he was involved with the Rome Theater Group. They owned a number of theaters, not the biggest, but at any rate, he came up with the brilliant idea to market these old theaters to churches. The theaters were dying off. This was the 70s, and TV had taken hold. The city was on a downhill spiral, I guess you would say, in the early 70s in many respects. People were leaving the city.
10,000 a year starting in the 70s.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so that contributed to the dilemma for the theaters. And so they were looking for a quick out. And there were many churches that were growing who jumped at the opportunity to buy one of these theaters. But what I discovered, which was interesting, is that many of these theaters, these churches rather, now are struggling. So if you had a young pastor who was very energetic, had a growing congregation in the 70s, if that pastor is still there, bless him, he's now,
getting up
50 years older, and
right.
His congregation has aged, and in many cases, these congregations have dwindled to a very few. And here they've got these big buildings that need upkeep and are 50 years older, and they don't have the money for the roof. So there are a number of theaters that I've been following which are really threatened because nobody is able to maintain them properly.
When you walk through this history, or in your case, walk through it with your camera, you walk through this history that you just described of white flight, mainly white flight, starting in the 50s, really. Baltimore's peak population was some 900,000 back in the 50s, and mm-hmm. we're at 625 now, so you can do the math there. And there were periods of time when it really accelerated, when there was a lot of movement, a lot of segregation, whites moving away from blacks, the Jewish migration across the city and up the Northwest. So you walk through all of that as you walk through this history. And a lot of it is very sad to think about the number of people who were here once upon a time that you needed all these theaters for. And then all these social changes, you know, what I just described, white flight, but also the advent of television and the growth of the suburbs. It's all sort of right there through this lens of yours, isn't it?
Exactly. I really look at this book as a story of Baltimore as seen through the prism of its theaters, the architectural prism, the social prism, the cultural prism. And what's happened in all these neighborhoods is what you describe. All of that has really hurt the viability of these buildings and the commercial main streets that were once bustling.
Did you come to an understanding of why the Royal Theater was knocked down?
The one thing everybody said to me when I interviewed people about the Royal was, I mean, virtually the wording was the same from every person. They never should have torn the Royal down.
I hear that. I've been hearing that for all these years that I've been in Baltimore. This was this palace on Pennsylvania Avenue, a center of entertainment. It goes back to the days of segregation, but it wasn't just movies. It was live acts, music, and some big names that played there over the years.
And that's one of the reasons it really resonated with people. The Hippodrome was the same thing. People would talk to me a lot about the Hippodrome. And it wasn't just the movies. It was the live acts.
They saved the
Hippodrome.
That
were very exciting. Exactly. This was, my personal opinion, is misguided urban renewal. Urban renewal was sort of a response, I guess I wouldn't really want to. I'm not in a position to analyze the whole philosophy and power struggles behind urban renewal, but the fact is that it happened in some neighborhoods more than others. It happened in the black neighborhoods. It happened on Pennsylvania Avenue. And it was painful for me, almost as much as for the people who lost their history, because I wanted to photograph theaters in every neighborhood, and it's very hard if there's no theater left. I didn't want to have a book of parking lots,
right.
and empty lots and garages. Mm. And there were a higher percentage of theaters in the Pennsylvania Avenue corridor, the African-American theaters, that had been torn down and replaced by gormless housing or things that were really tough to photograph. In the case of the Royal, I have a picture of a small monument that was placed on the block. It's a small ersatz replica of the Royal, and the block is a football field.
Right. You've got a photograph of three young boys who play football there.
Which is okay. I love that picture. The boys look so sweet. But we could have put a football field somewhere else.
Yeah.
I think there were other plots of land where that could have happened.
It's a real shame. I would have loved to have seen that theater.
I mean, look at the Howard Theater in D.C. That was so misguided. they were going to mow down, at the same time they were going to tear down the Royal and those blocks. They were supposed to do the same thing on the block.
On Baltimore Street.
But somehow the powers that be, they were able to stop it from happening at City Hall.
Did you find a favorite place? Did you discover an old theater that you just loved to look at and you enjoyed photographing?
I spent a lot of time looking at all of them, so there weren't any that I didn't like looking at.
But more than others. McHenry caught my eye in your book, and I've noticed that. It's in South Baltimore. It's on Light Street. Is there a favorite of yours?
I actually lived in that neighborhood and didn't realize that was a theater initially.
Yeah.
So the McHenry is the southern cousin, the more modest cousin of the Parkway Theater on North Avenue. Same architect, Oliver White. Same design, really. If you look at the front, you could see a lot of similarities there. I think as far as just looking at it, the Ambassador Theater on Liberty Heights is one that I do have special feelings for because it's really threatened now. And there's talk about reusing it, but the jury is still out on what will happen.
That looks like it could be a great theater.
That is in Howard Park, and it is a phenomenal Art Deco building. I think it's one of the best Art Deco buildings in Baltimore. And Baltimore doesn't have a lot of Art Deco. It's a 1935 building built by the Durkee Enterprises Group. And it's just stunning on the outside, and it was stunning on the inside. Sadly, it became a roller rink, a cosmetology school, or all sorts of wacky things, but in doing so, it's been gutted. There are some remnants inside, but it's had fires and different problems. They had an auction and nobody bought it. And
when you look at the photograph from 1935 that's in your book from the Baltimore Museum of Industry, it's just so stunning. It's like, can't we have that again?
Exactly.
Can't we have nice things?
You know, I hope people will turn the pages of this book and look at these beautiful old buildings, all glowing and neon lit, and say, can't we have that again?
Yeah.
In some fashion. We need people to move back.
We need people to move back to some of these neighborhoods, repopulate, so you have the mass that you need to support them. That would help if we started getting growing population again. What is Lens Baby? So this is a technical question. I love the book. The book is fantastic, and I congratulate you on finally getting it done. But I was curious about what Lens Baby is. I'm not a photographer, so. And how did you use it?
Lens Baby is a specialty lens, and it's not used by news photographers, so I don't use it in my work at The Sun. It's more popular with portrait photographers and wedding photographers, and it enables you to use selective focus. So I can focus on your eyes, let's say, but your hands or the background behind you can be out of focus. But you can vary the degree of blur. And I use it as a device to suggest the transition in time. As people look at these old theaters and relive their memories or just imagine if they weren't around at the time, what it might have looked like. I wanted to suggest that transitory nature and just that feeling of filling in the blanks where it's now a blur. It was also a way to be kind to these old buildings
that are afraid. The photographs are kind. But I'm so glad that you described that because when I saw this in your book, it made me think of how I look at old buildings when I move around town. When I said the McHenry caught my eye, what I mean is it makes me wonder what it was like way back then, how it was used. I get a picture of it in my head of people walking to it, buying a ticket, going inside. If you walk around Baltimore, you do that more than sometimes when you're driving, you miss these things. But when you walk around, you get that more of that sense of the way things used to be.
I do the same thing. Every place has layers of history.
Yeah.
People have layers of history. The buildings are kind of like people. I try to capture that in the old and new pictures and the combination of the two. And
I think you've done that with some of these photos. The word pentimento comes to mind, which is the emergence of an image in a painting that's been painted over. Poor artists used to have to paint over a painting that didn't sell, maybe.
Right.
And then years later, the original image starts to come through, and that's the Pentimento. And that's something you see in Baltimore a lot. You see with old churches, you see some old synagogues that emerge. If you look at them closely, you realize that was a synagogue. That was a movie theater.
That's a good way to look at life, isn't it? And certainly
the layers.
The photos do capture that. In one case, I photographed the destruction of the new theater. This was one of the downtown theater palaces on Lexington Street, and it was knocked down a few years ago. Again, it's just a grassy lot now. They haven't figured out what to do in that space on the west side. And when they knocked it down, it was difficult because they really built buildings well. It was hard for them to knock it down. But when they peeled away the facade, which was some kind of vinyl siding, the original masonry arch reappeared, and it was a palimpsest. And I just sort of, my heart stopped.
Wow.
I was already feeling emotional because I was watching the wrecking ball knock down grand theater.
Yeah, but
when the original theater reappeared, it was just a stunning moment for me, personally.
Because it was having its final flowering before it was torn down?
Seeing the photos that I had only seen at the Baltimore Museum of Industry.
Yeah.
I was seeing the old building reappear in its last gasp.
I wish you could save them all. Well, bring them all back. Well, that's great. Amy, congratulations. This is 10 years' work?
I guess I officially started it in 2008. I had done an essay in the Baltimore Sun, got a lot of letters from readers, and that encouraged me to turn the idea into a book.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Flickering Treasures, Rediscovering Baltimore's Forgotten Movie Theaters, runs for the next year at the National Building Museum on F Street Northwest in Washington. You can find more information about the exhibition in the notes with today's episode. Congratulations again to Amy Davis. I'm Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. For producers Steve Early and Hallie Miller, thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.